DNA, Watson had moved to the Department of Biology at Harvard and instantly raised the hackles of some of its most venerated professors. Biology, as Watson saw it, was a discipline splitting through its middle. On one side sat its old guard, natural historians, taxonomists, anatomists, and ecologists who were still preoccupied by the classifications of animals and by largely qualitative descriptions of organismal anatomy and physiology. The new biologists, in contrast, studied molecules and genes. The old school spoke of diversity and variation, the new school of universal codes, common mechanisms, and central dogmas. "Each generation needs a new music," Crickett said. Watson was frankly scornful of the old music. Natural history, a largely descriptive discipline, as Watson characterized it, would be replaced by a vigorous, muscular, experimental science that he had helped create. The dinosaurs who studied dinosaurs would soon become extinct in their own right. Watson called the old biologists stamp collectors, mocking their preoccupation with the collection and classification of biological specimens. But even Watson had to admit that the inability to perform directed genetic interventions or to read the exact nature of gene alterations was a frustration for new biology. If genes could be sequenced and manipulated, then a vast experimental landscape would be thrown open. Until then, biologists would be stuck probing gene function with the only available tool, the genesis of random mutations in simple organisms. To Watson's insult, a natural historian might have hurled an equal and opposite injury. If old biologists were stamp collectors, then the new molecular biologists were mutant hunters. Between 1970 and 1980, the mutant hunters transformed into gene manipulators and gene decoders. Consider this. In 1969, if a disease-linked gene was found in humans, scientists had no means to understand the nature of the mutation, no mechanism to compare the altered gene to normal form, and no obvious method to reconstruct the gene mutation in a different organism to study its function. By 1979, that same gene could be shuttled into bacteria, spliced into a viral vector, delivered into the genome of a mammalian cell, cloned, sequenced, and compared to the normal form. In December 1980, in recognition of these seminal advancements in genetic technologies, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded jointly to Fred Sanger, Walter Gilbert, and Paul Berg, the readers and writers of DNA. "The arsenal of chemical manipulations of genes," as one science journalist put it, "was now fully stocked. Genetic engineering," Peter Medawar, the biologist, wrote, "implies deliberate genetic change brought about by the manipulation of DNA, the vector of hereditary information." Is it not a major truth of technology that anything which is in principle possible will be done? Land on the moon? Yes, assuredly. Abolish smallpox? A pleasure. Make up for deficiencies in the human genome? Yes, though that's more difficult and will take longer. We aren't there yet, but we are certainly moving in the right direction. The technologies to manipulate, clone, and sequence genes may have been initially invented to shuttle genes between bacteria, viruses, and mammalian cells, a la Berg, Boyer, and Cohen. But the impact of these technologies reverberated broadly through organismal biology. Although the phrases gene cloning or molecular cloning were initially coined to refer to the production of identical copies of DNA, i.e. clones, in bacteria or viruses, they would soon become shorthand for the entire gamut of techniques that allowed biologists to extract genes from organisms, manipulate these genes in test tubes, produce gene hybrids, and propagate the genes in living organisms. You could only clone genes, after all, by using a combination of all these techniques. By learning to manipulate genes experimentally, Berg said, you could learn to manipulate organisms experimentally. And by mixing and matching gene manipulation and gene sequencing tools, a scientist could interrogate not just genetics, but the whole universe of biology with a kind of experimental audacity that was unimaginable in the past. Say an immunologist was trying to solve a fundamental riddle in immunology, the mechanism by which T cells recognize and kill foreign cells in the body. For decades, it had been known that T cells sense the presence of invading cells and virus-infected cells by virtue of a sensor found on the surface of the T cell. The sensor, called the T-cell receptor, is a protein made uniquely by T-cells. The receptor recognizes proteins on the surface of foreign cells and binds to them. The binding, in turn, triggers a signal to kill the invading cell and thereby acts as a defense mechanism for an organism. But what was the nature of the T-cell receptor? Biochemists had approached the problem with their typical penchant for reduction. They had obtained vats upon vats of T-cells, used soaps and detergents to dissolve the cell's components into a gray cellular froth, then distilled the membranes and lipids away and purified and repurified the material into smaller and smaller parts to hunt down the culprit protein. Yet the receptor protein, dissolved somewhere in that infernal soup, had remained elusive. A gene cloner might take an alternative approach. Assume for a moment that the distinctive feature of the T-cell receptor protein is that it is synthesized only in T-cells, not in neurons or ovaries or liver cells. The gene for the receptor must exist in every human cell. Human neurons, liver cells, and T-cells have identical genomes after all, but the RNA is made only in T-cells. Could one compare the RNA catalog of two different cells and thereby clone a functionally relevant gene from that catalog? The biochemist's approach pivots on concentration. Find the protein by looking where it's most likely to be concentrated and distill it out of the mix. The geneticist's approach, in contrast, pivots on information. Find the gene by searching for differences in databases created by two closely related cells and multiply the gene in bacteria via cloning. The biochemist distills forms. The gene cloner amplifies information. In 1970, David Baltimore and Howard Timmon, two virologists, made a pivotal discovery that made such comparisons possible. Working independently, Baltimore and Timmon discovered an enzyme found in retroviruses that could build DNA from an RNA template. They called the enzyme reverse transcriptase, reverse because it inverted the normal direction of information flow, from RNA back to DNA, or from a gene's message backward to a gene, thereby violating Crick's central dogma that genetic information only moved from genes to messages, but never backward. Using reverse transcriptase, every RNA in a cell could be used as a template to build its corresponding gene. A biologist could thus generate a catalog, or library, of all active genes in a cell, akin to a library of books grouped by a subject. There would be a library of genes for T-cells and another for red blood cells, a library for neurons in the retina, for insulin secreting cells of the pancreas, and so forth. By comparing libraries derived from two cells, a T-cell and a pancreas cell, say, an immunologist could fish out genes that were active in one cell and not the other. For example, insulin or the T-cell receptor. Once identified, that gene could be amplified a millionfold in bacteria. The gene could be isolated and sequenced, its RNA and protein sequence determined, its regulatory regions identified. It could be mutated and inserted into a different cell to decipher the gene's structure and function. In 1984, this technique was deployed to clone the T-cell receptor, a landmark achievement in immunology. Biology, as one geneticist later recalled, was liberated by cloning, and the field began to erupt with surprises. Mysterious, important, elusive genes sought for decades, genes for blood clotting proteins, for regulators of growth, for antibodies and hormones, for transmitters between nerves, genes to control the replication of other genes, genes implicated in cancer, diabetes, depression, and heart disease, would soon be purified and cloned using gene libraries derived from cells as their source. Every field of biology was transformed by gene cloning and gene sequencing technology. If experimental biology was the new music, then the gene was its conductor, its orchestra, its assonant refrain, its principal instrument, its score. Einstein's on the beach. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat. William Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, Act 4, Scene 3. I believe in the inalienable right of all adult scientists to make absolute fools of themselves in private. Sidney Brenner. In Arice, near the western coast of Sicily, a 12th century Norman fortress rises 2,000 feet above the ground on a furrow of rock. Viewed from afar, the fortress seems to have been created by some natural heave of the landscape, its stone flanks emerging from the rock face of the cliff as if through metamorphosis. The Arice Castle, or Venus Castle, as some call it, was built on the site of an ancient Roman temple. The older building was dismantled, stone by stone, and reassembled to form the walls, turrets, and towers of the castle. The shrine of the original temple has long vanished, but it was rumored to be dedicated to Venus. The Roman goddess of fertility, sex, and desire, Venus was conceived unnaturally from the spume spilled from Celis's genitals into the sea. In the summer of 1972, a few months after Paul Berg had created the first DNA chimeras at Stanford, he traveled to Arice to give a scientific seminar at a meeting. He arrived in Palermo late in the evening and took a 2-hour taxi ride toward the coast. Night fell quickly. When he asked a stranger to give him directions to the town, the man gestured vaguely into the darkness where a flickering decimal point of light seemed suspended 2,000 feet in the air. The meeting began the next morning. The audience comprised about 80 young men and women from Europe, mostly graduate students in biology and a few professors. Berg gave an informal lecture, a rap session, he called it, presenting his data on gene chimeras, recombinant DNA, and the production of the virus-bacteria hybrids. The students were electrified. Berg was inundated with questions, as he had expected, but the direction of the conversation surprised him. At Janet Mertz's presentation at Cold Spring Harbor in 1971, the biggest concern had been safety. How could Berg or Mertz guarantee that their genetic chimeras would not unleash biological chaos on humans? In Sicily, in contrast, the conversation turned quickly to politics, culture, and ethics. "What about the specter of genetic engineering in humans, behavior control?" Berg recalled. "What if we could cure genetic diseases," the students asked, "or program people's eye color, intelligence, height? What would the implications be for humans and human societies? Who would ensure that genetic technologies would not be seized and perverted by powerful forces, as once before on that continent?" Berg had obviously stoked an old fire. In America, the prospect of gene manipulation had principally raised the specter of future biological dangers. In Italy, not more than a few hundred miles from the sites of the former Nazi extermination camps, it was the moral hazards of genetics, more than the biohazards of genes, that haunted the conversation. That evening, a German student gathered an impromptu group of his peers to continue the debate. They climbed the ramparts of the Venus Castle and looked out toward the darkening coast, with the lights of the city blinking below. Berg and the students stayed up late into the night for a second session, drinking beers and talking about natural and unnatural conceptions, the beginning of a new era, its possible hazards, and the prospects of genetic engineering. In January 1973, a few months after the Arice trip, Berg decided to organize a small conference in California to address the growing concerns about gene manipulation technologies. The meeting was held at the Pacific Groves Conference Center at Asilomar, a sprawling, wind-buffeted complex of buildings on the edge of the ocean near Monterey Bay, about 80 miles from Stanford. Scientists from all disciplines, virologists, geneticists, biochemists, microbiologists, attended. Asilomar 1, as Berg would later call the meeting, generated enormous interest but few recommendations. Much of the meeting focused on biosafety issues. The use of SV40 and other human viruses was hotly discussed. "Back then, we were still using our mouths to pipette viruses and chemicals," Berg told me. Berg's assistant, Marion Dykman, once recalled a student who had accidentally flecked some liquid onto the tip of a cigarette. It was not unusual, for that matter, to have half-lit cigarettes smoldering in ashtrays strewn across the lab. The student had just shrugged and continued to smoke, with the droplet of virus disintegrating into ash. The Asilomar Conference produced an important book, Biohazards and Biological Research, but its larger conclusion was in the negative. As Berg described it, what came out of it, frankly, was the recognition of how little we know. Concerns about gene cloning were further inflamed in the summer of 1973 when Boyer and Cohen presented their experiments on bacterial gene hybrids at another conference. At Stanford, meanwhile, Berg was being flooded with requests from researchers around the world asking for gene recombination reagents. One researcher from Chicago proposed inserting genes of the highly pathogenic human herpes virus into bacterial cells, thereby creating a human intestinal bacterium loaded with a lethal toxin gene, ostensibly to study the toxicity of herpes virus genes. Berg politely declined. Antibiotic resistance genes were routinely being swapped between bacteria. Genes were being shuffled between species and genera, leaping across a million years of evolutionary rift as if casually stepping over thin lines in sand. Noting the growing swirl of uncertainties, the National Academy of Sciences called on Berg to lead a study panel on gene recombination. The panel, 8 scientists including Berg, Watson, David Baltimore, and Norton Zinder, met at MIT in Boston on a chilly spring afternoon in April 1973. They instantly got to work brainstorming possible mechanisms to control and regulate gene cloning. Baltimore suggested the development of safe viruses, plasmids, and bacteria which would be crippled and thereby be unable to cause disease. But even that safety measure was not foolproof. Who would ensure that crippled viruses would remain permanently crippled? Viruses and bacteria were, after all, not passive, inert objects. Even within laboratory environments, they were living, evolving, moving targets. One mutation and a previously disabled bacterium might spring to virulent life again. The debate had gone on for several hours when Zinder proposed a plan that seemed almost reactionary. "Well, if we had any guts at all, we'd just tell people not to do these experiments." The proposal created a quiet stir around the table. It was far from an ideal solution. There was something obviously disingenuous about scientists telling scientists to restrict their scientific work, but it would at least act as a temporary stay order. "Unpleasant as it was, we thought it might just work," Berg recalled. The panel drafted a formal letter pleading for a moratorium on certain kinds of recombinant DNA research. The letter weighed the risks and benefits of gene recombination technologies and suggested that certain experiments be deferred until the safety issues had been addressed. Not every conceivable experiment was dangerous, Berg noted, but some were clearly more hazardous than others. 3 types of procedures involving recombinant DNA, in particular, needed to be sharply restricted. Don't put toxin genes into E. coli, don't put drug-resistant genes into E. coli, and don't put cancer genes into E. coli, Berg advised. With a moratorium in place, Berg and his colleagues argued scientists could buy some time to consider the implications of their work. A second meeting was proposed for 1975, where the issues could be debated among a larger group of scientists. In 1974, the Berg letter ran in Nature, Science, and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It drew instant attention around the globe. In Britain, a committee was formed to address the potential benefits and potential hazards of recombinant DNA and gene cloning. In France, reactions to the letter were published in Le Monde. That winter, François Jacob, of gene regulation fame, was asked to review a grant application that proposed inserting a human muscle gene into a virus. Following Berg's footsteps, Jacob urged tabling such proposals until a national response to recombinant DNA technology had been drafted. At a meeting in Germany in 1974, many geneticists reiterated a similar caution. Sharp constraints on experiments with recombinant DNA research were essential until the risks had been delineated and recommendations formalized. The research, meanwhile, was steamrolling ahead, knocking down biological and evolutionary barriers as if they had been propped up on toothpicks. At Stanford, Boyer, Cohen, and their students grafted a gene for penicillin resistance from one bacterium onto another, and thereby created drug-resistant E. coli. In principle, any gene could be transferred from one organism to the next. Audaciously, Boyer and Cohen projected forward. It may be practical to introduce genes specifying metabolic or synthetic functions that are indigenous to other biological classes, such as plants and animals. Species, Boyer declared jokingly, are specious. On New Year's Day, 1974, a researcher working with Cohen at Stanford reported that he had inserted a frog gene into a bacterial cell. Another evolutionary border was casually crossed, another boundary transgressed. In biology, being natural, as Oscar Wilde once put it, was turning out to be simply a pose. Asilomar II, one of the most unusual meetings in the history of science, was organized by Berg, Baltimore, and three other scientists for February 1975. Once again, geneticists returned to the windy beach dunes to discuss genes, recombination, and the shape of the future. It was an evocatively beautiful season. Monarch butterflies were migrating along the coast on their annual visit to the grasslands of Canada, and the redwoods and scrub pines were suddenly alit by a flotilla of red, orange, and black. The human visitors arrived on February 24th, but not just biologists. Cannily, Berg in Baltimore had asked lawyers, journalists, and writers to join the conference. If the future of gene manipulation was to be discussed, they wanted opinions not just from scientists, but from a much larger group of thinkers. The wood-decked pathways around the conference center allowed discursive conversations. Walking on the decks or on the sand flats, biologists could trade notes on recombination, cloning, and gene manipulation. In contrast, the central hall, a stone-walled cathedral-like space ablaze with sepulchral California light, was the epicenter of the conference, where the fiercest debates on gene cloning would soon erupt. Berg spoke first. He summarized the data and outlined the scope of the problem. In the course of investigating methods to chemically alter DNA, biochemists had recently discovered a relatively facile technique to mix and match genetic information from different organisms. The technology, as Berg put it, was so ridiculously simple that even an amateur biologist could produce chimeric genes in a lab. These hybrid DNA molecules, recombinant DNA, could be propagated and expanded, i.e. cloned, in bacteria to generate millions of identical copies. Some of these molecules could be shuttled into mammalian cells. Recognizing the profound potential and risks of this technology, a preliminary meeting had suggested a temporary moratorium on experiments. The Asilomar II meeting had been convened to deliberate on the next steps. Eventually, this second meeting would so far overshadow the first in its influence and scope that it would be called simply the Asilomar Conference, or just Asilomar. Tensions and tempers flared quickly on the first morning. The main issue was still the self-imposed moratorium. Should scientists be restricted in their experiments with recombinant DNA? Watson was against it. He wanted perfect freedom. Let the scientists loose on the science, he urged. Baltimore and Brenner reiterated their plan to create crippled gene carriers to ensure safety. Others were deeply divided. The scientific opportunities were enormous, they argued, and a moratorium might paralyze progress. One microbiologist was particularly incensed by the severity of the proposed restrictions. "You fucked the plasmid group," he accused the committee. At one point, Berg threatened to sue Watson for failing to adequately acknowledge the nature of the risk of recombinant DNA. Brenner asked a journalist from the Washington Post to turn off his recorder during a particularly sensitive session on the risks of gene cloning. "I believe in the inalienable right of all adult scientists to make absolute fools of themselves in private," he said. He was promptly accused of being a fascist. The five members of the organizing committee, Berg, Baltimore, Brenner, Richard Roblin, and Maxine Singer, the biochemist, anxiously made rounds of the room, assessing the rising temperature. "Arguments went on and on," one journalist wrote. "Some people got sick of it all and went out to the beach to smoke marijuana." Berg sat in his room, glowering, worried that the conference would end with no conclusions at all. Nothing had been formalized by the last evening of the conference until the lawyers took the stage. The five attorneys asked to discuss the legal ramifications of cloning and laid out a grim vision of potential risks. If a single member of a laboratory was infected by a recombinant microbe, and that infection led to even the palest manifestations of a disease, they argued, the laboratory head, the lab, and the institution would be held legally liable. Whole universities would shut down. Labs would be closed indefinitely, their front doors picketed by activists and locked by hazmat men in astronaut suits. The NIH would be flooded with queries. All hell would break loose. The federal government would respond by proposing draconian regulations, not just on recombinant DNA, but on a larger swath of biological research. The result could be restrictions vastly more stringent than any rules that scientists might be willing to impose on themselves. The lawyer's presentation, held strategically on the last day of Asilomar II, was the turning point for the entire meeting. Berg realized that the meeting should not, could not, end without formal recommendations. That evening, Baltimore, Berg, Singer, Brenner, and Roblin stayed up late in their cabana, eating Chinese takeout from paper cartons, scribbling on a blackboard, and drafting a plan for the future. At 5:30 in the morning, disheveled and bleary-eyed, they emerged from the beach house smelling of coffee and typewriter ink, with a document in hand. The document began with the recognition of the strange parallel universe of biology that scientists had unwittingly entered with gene cloning. The new techniques, which permit combination of genetic information from very different organisms, place us in an arena of biology with many unknowns. It is this ignorance that has compelled us to conclude that it would be wise to exercise considerable caution in performing this research. To mitigate the risks, the document proposed a four-level scheme to rank the biohazard potentials of various genetically altered organisms, with recommended containment facilities for each level. Inserting a cancer-causing gene into a human virus, for instance, would merit the highest level of containment, while placing a frog gene into a bacterial cell might merit minimal containment. As Baltimore and Brenner had insisted, it proposed the development of crippled gene-carrying organisms and vectors to further contain them in laboratories. Finally, it urged continuous review of recombination and containment procedures, with the possibility of loosening or tightening restrictions in the near future. When the meeting opened at 8:30 on the last morning, the five members of the committee worried that the proposal would be rejected. Surprisingly, it was near unanimously accepted. In the aftermath of the Asilomar conference, several historians of science have tried to grasp the scope of the meeting by seeking an analogous moment in scientific history. There is none. The closest one gets to a similar document, perhaps, is a two-page letter written in August 1939 by Albert Einstein and Leo Szilard to alert President Roosevelt to the alarming possibility of a powerful war weapon in the making. A new and important source of energy had been discovered, Einstein wrote, through which vast amounts of power might be generated. This new phenomenon would also lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. A single bomb of this type carried by boat and exploded in a port might very well destroy the whole port. The Einstein-Szilard letter had generated an immediate response. Sensing the urgency, Roosevelt had appointed a scientific commission to investigate it. Within a few months, Roosevelt's commission would become the Advisory Committee on Uranium. By 1942, it would morph further into the Manhattan Project and ultimately culminate in the creation of the atomic bomb. But Asilomar was different. Here, scientists were alerting themselves to the perils of their own technology and seeking to regulate and constrain their own work. Historically, scientists had rarely sought to become self-regulators. As Alan Waterman, the head of the National Science Foundation, wrote in 1962, "Science, in its pure form, is not interested in where discoveries may lead. Its disciples are interested only in discovering the truth." But with recombinant DNA, Berg argued, scientists could no longer afford to focus merely on discovering the truth. The truth was complex and inconvenient, and it required sophisticated assessment. Extraordinary technologies demand extraordinary caution, and political forces could hardly be trusted to assess the perils of the promise of gene cloning. Nor, for that matter, had political forces been particularly wise about handling genetic technologies in the past, as the students had pointedly reminded Berg at Erice. In 1973, less than 2 years before Asilomar, Nixon, fed up with his scientific advisors, had vengefully scrapped the Office of Science and Technology, sending spasms of anxiety through the scientific community. Impulsive, authoritarian, and suspicious of science, even at the best of times, the president might impose arbitrary control on scientists' autonomy at any time. A crucial choice was at stake. Scientists could relinquish the control of gene cloning to unpredictable regulators and find their work arbitrarily constrained, or they could become science regulators themselves. How are biologists to confront the risks and uncertainties of recombinant DNA? By using the methods that they knew best, gathering data, sifting evidence, evaluating risks, making decisions under uncertainty, and quarreling relentlessly. The most important lesson of Asilomar, Berg said, was to demonstrate that scientists were capable of self-governance. Those accustomed to the unfettered pursuit of research would have to learn to fetter themselves. The second distinctive feature of Asilomar concerned the nature of communications between scientists and the public. The Einstein-Szilard letter had been deliberately shrouded in secrecy. Asilomar, in contrast, sought to air the concerns about gene cloning in the most public forum possible. As Berg put it, the public's trust was undeniably increased by the fact that more than 10% of the participants were from the news media. They were free to describe, comment on, and criticize the discussions and conclusions. The deliberations, bickering, bitter accusations, wavering views, and the arrival at a consensus were widely chronicled by the reporters that attended. A final feature of Asilomar deserves commentary, notably for its absence. While the biological risks of gene cloning were extensively discussed at the meeting, virtually no mention was made of the ethical and moral dimensions of the problem. What would happen once human genes were manipulated in human cells? What if we began to write new material into our own genes and potentially our genomes? The conversation that Berg had started in Sicily was never rejuvenated. Later, Berg reflected on this lacuna. Did the organizers and participants of the Asilomar conference deliberately limit the scope of the concerns? Others have been critical of the conference because it did not confront the potential misuse of the recombinant DNA technology or the ethical dilemmas that would arise from applying the technology to genetic screening and gene therapy. It should not be forgotten that these possibilities were still far in the future. In short, the agenda for the three-day meeting had to focus on an assessment of the biohazard risks. We accepted that the other issues would be dealt with as they became imminent and estimable. The absence of this discussion was noted by several participants, but it was never addressed during the meeting itself. It is a theme to which we will return. In the spring of 1993, I traveled to Asilomar with Berg and a group of researchers from Stanford. I was a student in Berg's lab then, and this was the annual retreat for the department. We left Stanford in a caravan of cars and vans, hugging the coast at Santa Cruz, and then heading out toward the narrow cormorant neck of the Monterey Peninsula. Kornberg and Berg drove ahead. I was in a rental van driven by a graduate student and accompanied, improbably, by an opera diva-turned-biochemist who worked on DNA replication and occasionally burst into strains of Puccini. On the last day of our meeting, I took a walk through the scrub pine groves with Marianne Dyckman, Berg's long-term research assistant and collaborator. Dyckman guided me through an unorthodox tour of Asilomar, pointing out the places where the fiercest mutinies and arguments had broken out. This was an expedition through a landscape of disagreements. Asilomar, she told me, was the most quarrelsome meeting that I have ever attended. What did these quarrels achieve? I asked. Dyckman paused, looking toward the sea. The tide had gone out, leaving the beach carved in the shadows of waves. She used her toe to draw a line on the wet sand. More than anything, Asilomar marked a transition, she said. The capacity to manipulate genes represented nothing short of a transformation in genetics. We had learned a new language. We needed to convince ourselves and everyone else that we were responsible enough to use it. It is the impulse of science to try to understand nature and the impulse of technology to try to manipulate it. Recombinant DNA has pushed genetics from the realm of science into the realm of technology. Genes were not abstractions anymore. They could be liberated from the genomes of organisms where they had been trapped for millennia, shuttled between species, amplified, purified, extended, shortened, altered, remixed, mutated, mixed, matched, cut, pasted, edited. They were infinitely malleable to human intervention. Genes were no longer just the subjects of study, but the instruments of study. There is an illuminated moment in the development of a child when she grasps the recursiveness of language. Just as thoughts can be used to generate words, she realizes, words can be used to generate thoughts. Recombinant DNA had made the language of genetics recursive. Biologists had spent decades trying to interrogate the nature of the gene, but now it was the gene that could be used to interrogate biology. We had graduated, in short, from thinking about genes to thinking in genes. Asilomar then marked the crossing of these pivotal lines. It was a celebration, an appraisal, an assembly, a confrontation, a warning. It began with a speech and ended with a document. It was the graduation ceremony for the new genetics. Clone or die? If you know the question, you know half. Herb Boyer. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Arthur C. Clarke. Stan Cohen and Herb Boyer had also gone to Asilomar to debate the future of recombinant DNA. They found the conference irritating, even deflating. Boyer could not bear the infighting and the name-calling. He called the scientists self-serving and the meeting a nightmare. Cohen refused to sign the Asilomar Agreement, although as a grantee of the NIH, he would eventually have to comply with it. Back in their own laboratories, they returned to an issue that they had neglected amid the commotion. In May 1974, Cohen's lab had published the Frog Prince experiment, the transfer of a frog gene into a bacterial cell. When asked by a colleague how he had identified the bacteria expressing the frog genes, Cohen had jokingly said that he had kissed the bacteria to check which ones would transform into a prince. At first, the experiment had been an academic exercise. It had only turned biochemists' heads. Joshua Lederberg, the Nobel Prize-winning biologist and Cohen's colleague at Stanford, was among the few who wrote, presciently, that the experiment may completely change the pharmaceutical industry's approach to making biological elements, such as insulin and antibiotics. But slowly, the media awoke to the potential impact of the study. In May, the San Francisco Chronicle ran a story on Cohen, focusing on the possibility that gene-modified bacteria might someday be used as biological factories for drugs or chemicals. Soon, articles on gene cloning technologies had appeared in Newsweek and the New York Times. Cohen also received a quick baptism on the seamy side of scientific journalism. Having spent an afternoon talking patiently to a newspaper reporter about recombinant DNA and bacterial gene transfer, he awoke the next morning to the hysterical headline, "Man-made bugs ravage the Earth." At Stanford University's patent office, Niels Reimers, a savvy former engineer, read about Cohen and Boyer's work through these news outlets and was intrigued by its potential. Reimers, less patent officer and more talent scout, was active and aggressive. Rather than waiting for inventors to bring him inventions, he scoured the scientific literature on his own for possible leads. Reimers approached Boyer and Cohen, urging them to file a joint patent on their work on gene cloning. Stanford and UCSF, their respective institutions, would also be part of that patent. Both Cohen and Boyer were surprised. During their experiments, they had not even broached the idea that recombinant DNA techniques could be patentable, or that the technique could carry future commercial value. In the winter of 1974, still skeptical, but willing to humor Reimers, Cohen and Boyer filed a patent for recombinant DNA technology. News of the gene cloning patent filtered back to scientists. Kornberg and Berg were furious. Cohen and Boyer's claims to commercial ownership of the techniques for cloning all possible DNAs in all possible vectors, joined in all possible ways in all possible organisms, is dubious, presumptuous, and hubristic, Berg wrote. The patent would privatize the products of biological research that had been paid for with public money, they argued. Berg also worried that the recommendations of the Asilomar Conference could not be adequately policed and enforced in private companies. To Boyer and Cohen, however, all of this seemed much ado about nothing. Their patent on recombinant DNA was no more than a sheaf of paper making its way between legal offices, worth less, perhaps, than the ink that had been used to print it. In the fall of 1975, with mounds of paperwork still moving through legal channels, Cohen and Boyer parted scientific ways. Their collaboration had been immensely productive. Together, they had published 11 landmark papers over 5 years, but their interests had begun to drift apart. Cohen became a consultant to a company called Cetus in California. Boyer returned to his lab in San Francisco to concentrate on his experiments on bacterial gene transfer. In the winter of 1975, a 28-year-old venture capitalist, Robert Swanson, called Herb Boyer out of the blue to suggest a meeting. A connoisseur of popular science magazines and sci-fi films, Swanson had also heard about a new technology called recombinant DNA. Swanson had an instinct for technology. Even though he knew barely any biology, he had sensed that recombinant DNA represented a tectonic shift in thinking about genes and heredity. He had dug up a dog-eared handbook from the Acelomar meeting, made a list of important players working on gene cloning techniques, and had started working down the list alphabetically. Berg came before Boyer, but Berg, who had no patience for opportunistic entrepreneurs making cold calls to his lab, turned Swanson down. Swanson swallowed his pride and kept going down the list. B. Boyer was next. Would Boyer consider a meeting? Immersed in experiments, Herb Boyer fielded Swanson's phone call distractedly one morning. He offered 10 minutes of his time on a Friday afternoon. Swanson came to see Boyer in January 1976. The lab was located in the grimy innards of the Medical Sciences Building at UCSF. Swanson wore a dark suit and tie. Boyer appeared amid mounds of half-rotting bacterial plates and incubators and jeans in his trademark leather vest. Boyer knew little about Swanson, only that he was a venture capitalist looking to form a company around recombinant DNA. Had Boyer investigated further, he might have discovered that nearly all of Swanson's prior investments in fledgling ventures had failed. Swanson was out of work, living in a rent-shared apartment in San Francisco, driving a broken Datsun, and eating cold-cut sandwiches for lunch and dinner. The assigned 10 minutes grew into a marathon meeting. They walked to a neighborhood bar, talking about recombinant DNA and the future of biology. Swanson proposed starting a company that would use gene-cloning techniques to make medicines. Boyer was fascinated. His own son had been diagnosed with a potential growth disorder, and Boyer had been gripped by the possibility of producing human growth hormone, a protein to treat such growth defects. He knew that he might be able to make growth hormone in his lab by using his own method of stitching genes and inserting them into bacterial cells, but it would be useless. No sane person would inject his or her child with bacterial broth grown in a test tube in a science lab. To make a medical product, Boyer needed to create a new kind of pharmaceutical company, one that would make medicines out of genes. 3 hours and 3 beers later, Swanson and Boyer had reached a tentative agreement. They would pitch in $500 each to cover legal fees to start such a company. Swanson wrote up a 6-page plan. He approached his former employers, the venture firm Kleiner Perkins, for $500,000 in seed money. The firm took a quick look at the proposal and slashed that number fivefold to $100,000. "This investment is highly speculative," Perkins later wrote apologetically to a California regulator, "but we are in the business of making highly speculative investments." Boyer and Swanson had nearly all the ingredients for a new company, except for a product and a name. The first potential product, at least, was obvious from the start: insulin. Despite many attempts to synthesize it using alternative methods, insulin was still being produced from mashed-up cow and pig innards, a pound of hormone from 8,000 pounds of pancreas, a near-medieval method that was inefficient, expensive, and outdated. If Boyer and Swanson could express insulin as a protein via gene manipulation in cells, it would be a landmark achievement for a new company. That left the issue of the name. Boyer rejected Swanson's suggestion of Herbob, which sounded like a hair salon on the Castro. In a flash of inspiration, Boyer suggested a condensation of genetic engineering technology, Genentech. Insulin, the Garbo of hormones. In 1869, a Berlin medical student, Paul Langerhans, had looked through a microscope at the pancreas, a fragile leaf of tissue tucked under the stomach, and discovered minute islands of distinct-looking cells studded across it. These cellular archipelagos were later named the islets of Langerhans, but their function remained mysterious. 2 decades later, two surgeons, Oskar Minkowski and Josef von Mering, had surgically removed the pancreas from a dog to identify the function of the organ. The dog was struck by an implacable thirst and began to urinate on the floor. Mering and Minkowski were mystified. Why had removing an abdominal organ precipitated this odd syndrome? The clue emerged from a throwaway fact. A few days later, an assistant noted that the lab was buzzing with flies. They were swarming on the pools of dog urine that had now congealed and turned sticky like treacle. When Murring and Minkowski tested the urine and the dog's blood, both were overflowing with sugar. The dog had become severely diabetic. Some factor synthesized in the pancreas, they realized, must regulate blood sugar, and its dysfunction must cause diabetes. The sugar-regulating factor was later found to be a hormone, a protein secreted into the blood by those islet cells that Langerhans had identified. The hormone was called islet, and then insulin, literally island protein. The identification of insulin in pancreatic tissue led to a race to purify it, but it took two further decades to isolate the protein from animals. Ultimately, in 1921, Banting and Best extracted a few micrograms of the substance out of dozens of pounds of cow pancreases. Injected into diabetic children, the hormone rapidly restored proper blood sugar levels and stopped their thirst and urination. But the hormone was notoriously difficult to work with. Insoluble, heat labile, temperamental, unstable, mysterious, insular. In 1953, after three more decades, Fred Sanger deduced the amino acid sequence of insulin. The protein, Sanger found, was made of two chains, one larger and one smaller, cross-linked by chemical bonds. U-shaped like a tiny molecular hand with clasped fingers and an opposing thumb, the protein was poised to turn the knobs and dials that so potently regulated sugar metabolism in the body. Boyer's plan for the synthesis of insulin was almost comically simple. He did not have the gene for human insulin at hand, no one did, but he would build it from scratch using DNA chemistry, nucleotide by nucleotide, triplet upon triplet, ATG, CCC, TCC, and so forth, all the way from the first triplet code to the last. He would make one gene for the A chain and another gene for the B chain. He would insert both the genes in bacteria and trick them into synthesizing the human proteins. He would purify the two protein chains and then stitch them chemically to obtain the U-shaped molecule. It was a child's plan. He would build the most ardently sought molecule in clinical medicine block by block out of an erector set of DNA. But even Boyer, adventurous as he was, blanched at lunging straight for insulin. He wanted an easier test case, a more pliant peak to scale before attempting the Everest of molecules. He focused on another protein, somatostatin, also a hormone, but with little commercial potential. Its main advantage was size. Insulin was a daunting 51 amino acids in length, 21 in one chain and 30 in the other. Somatostatin was its duller, shorter cousin with just 14. To synthesize the somatostatin gene from scratch, Boyer recruited two chemists from the City of Hope Hospital in Los Angeles, K.G. Itakura and Art Riggs, both veterans of DNA synthesis. Swanson was bitterly opposed to the whole plan. Somatostatin, he feared, would turn into a distraction. He wanted Boyer to move to insulin directly. Genentech was living in borrowed space on borrowed money. Scratched even a millimeter below its surface, the pharma company was, in truth, a rented cubicle in an office space in San Francisco, with an offshoot in a microbiology lab at UCSF, which, in turn, was about to subcontract two chemists at yet another lab to make genes, a pharmaceutical Ponzi scheme. Still, Boyer convinced Swanson to give somatostatin a chance. They hired an attorney, Tom Kiley, to negotiate the agreements among UCSF, Genentech, and the City of Hope. Kiley had never heard the term molecular biology, but felt confident because of his track record of representing unusual cases. Before Genentech, his most famous former client had been Miss Nude America. Time, too, felt borrowed at Genentech. Boyer and Swanson knew that two reigning wizards of genetics had also entered the race to make insulin. At Harvard, Walter Gilbert, the DNA chemist who would share the Nobel Prize with Berg and Sanger, was leading a formidable team of scientists to synthesize insulin using gene cloning. And at UCSF, in Boyer's own backyard, another team was racing toward the gene cloning. I think it was on our minds most of the time, most days, one of Boyer's collaborators recalled. I thought about it all the time. Are we going to hear an announcement that Gilbert has been successful? By the summer of 1977, working frantically under Boyer's anxious eye, Riggs and Itakura had assembled all the reagents for the synthesis of somatostatin. The gene fragments had been created and inserted into a bacterial plasmid. The bacteria had been transformed, grown, and prepped for the production of the protein. In June, Boyer and Swanson flew to Los Angeles to witness the final act. The team gathered in Riggs's lab in the morning. They leaned over to watch the molecular detectors check for the appearance of somatostatin in the bacteria. The counters blinked on, then off. Silence. Not even the faintest blip of a functional protein. Swanson was devastated. The next morning he developed acute indigestion and was sent to the emergency room. The scientists, meanwhile, recovered over coffee and donuts, poring through the experimental plan, troubleshooting. Boyer, who had worked with bacteria for decades, knew that microbes often digest their own proteins. Perhaps somatostatin had been destroyed by the bacteria, a microbe's last stand against being co-opted by human geneticists. The solution, he surmised, would be to add another trick to the bag of tricks. They would hook the somatostatin gene to another bacterial gene to make a conjoined protein, then cleave off the somatostatin after. It was a genetic bait and switch. The bacteria would think they were making a bacterial protein, but would end up secretly secreting a human one. It took another 3 months to assemble the decoy gene, with somatostatin now Trojan-horsed within another bacterial gene. In August 1977, the team reassembled at Riggs's lab for the second time. Swanson nervously watched the monitors flicker on and momentarily turned his face away. The detectors for the protein crackled again in the background. As Itakura recalled, "We have about 10, maybe 15 samples. Then we look at the printout of the radioimmunoassay, and the printout shows clearly that the gene is expressed." He turned to Swanson. "Somatostatin is there." Genentech scientists could barely stop to celebrate the success of the somatostatin experiment. One evening, one new human protein. By the next morning, the scientists had regrouped and made plans to attack insulin. The competition was fierce and rumors abounded. Gilbert's team had apparently cloned the native human gene out of human cells and were readying to make the protein in buckets. Or the UCSF competitors had synthesized a few micrograms of protein and were planning to inject the human hormone into patients. Perhaps somatostatin had been a distraction. Swanson and Boyer suspected ruefully that they had taken a wrong turn and been left behind in the insulin race. Dyspeptic even during the best of times, Swanson edged toward another bout of anxiety and indigestion. Ironically, it was Asilomar, the very meeting that Boyer had so vociferously disparaged, that came to their rescue. Like most university laboratories with federal funding, Gilbert's lab at Harvard was bound by the Asilomar restrictions on recombinant DNA. The restrictions were especially severe because Gilbert was trying to isolate the natural human gene and clone it into bacterial cells. In contrast, Riggs and Itakura, following the lead with somatostatin, had decided to use a chemically synthesized version of the insulin gene, building it up nucleotide by nucleotide from scratch. A synthetic gene, DNA created as a naked chemical, fell into the gray zone of Asilomar's language and was relatively exempt. Genentech, as a privately funded company, was also relatively exempt from the federal guidelines. The combination of factors proved to be a crucial advantage for the company. As one worker recalled, Gilbert was, as he had for many days past, trudging through an airlock, dipping his shoes in formaldehyde on his way into the chamber in which he was obliged to conduct his experiments. Out at Genentech, we were simply synthesizing DNA and throwing it into bacteria, none of which even required compliance with the NIH guidelines. In the world of post-Asilomar genetics, being natural had turned out to be a liability. Genentech's office, the glorified booth in San Francisco, was no longer adequate. Swanson began scouring the city for lab space for his nascent company. In the spring of 1978, having searched up and down the Bay Area, he found a suitable site. stretched across a tawny, sun-scorched flank of hillside a few miles south of San Francisco. The place was called Industrial City, although it was hardly industrial and barely a city. Genentech's lab was 10,000 square feet of a raw warehouse on 460 Point San Bruno Boulevard, set amid storage silos, dump sites, and airport freight hangars. The back half of the warehouse housed a storage facility for a distributor of porn videos. You'd go through the back of Genentech's door, and there would be all these movies on shelves, one early recruit wrote. Boyer hired a few additional scientists, some barely out of graduate school, and began to install equipment. Walls were constructed to divide the vast space. A makeshift lab was created by slinging black tarp across part of the roof. The first fermenter to grow gallons of microbial sludge, an upscale beer vat, arrived that year. David Goodell, the company's third employee, walked around the warehouse in sneakers and a black T-shirt that read, "Clone or Die." Yet no human insulin was in sight. In Boston, Swanson knew, Gilbert had upped his war effort, literally. Fed up with the constraints on recombinant DNA at Harvard, on the streets of Cambridge, young protesters were carrying placards against gene cloning. Gilbert had gained access to a high-security biological warfare facility in England and dispatched a team of his best scientists there. The conditions in the military facility were absurdly stringent. You totally change your clothes. Shower in, shower out, have gas masks available so that if the alarm goes off, you can sterilize the entire laboratory, Gilbert recalled. The UCSF team, in turn, sent a student to a pharmaceutical lab in Strasbourg, France, hoping to create insulin at the well-secured French facility. Gilbert's group oscillated at the brink of success. In the summer of 1978, Boyer learned that Gilbert's team was about to announce the successful isolation of the human insulin gene. Swanson braced himself for another breakdown, his third. To his immense relief, the gene that Gilbert had cloned was not human, but rat insulin, a contaminant that had somehow tainted the carefully sterilized cloning equipment. Cloning had made it easy to cross the barriers between species, but that same breach meant that a gene from one species could contaminate another in a biochemical reaction. In the narrow cleft of time between Gilbert's move to England and the mistaken cloning of rat insulin, Genentech forged ahead. It was an inverted fable, an academic Goliath versus a pharmaceutical David, one lumbering, powerful, handicapped by size, the other nimble, quick, adept at dancing around rules. By May 1978, the Genentech team had synthesized the two chains of insulin in bacteria. By July, the scientists had purified the proteins out of the bacteria debris. In early August, they snipped off the attached bacterial proteins and isolated the two individual chains. Late at night on August 21, 1978, Goodell joined the protein chains together in a test tube to create the first molecules of recombinant insulin. In September 1978, 2 weeks after Goodell had created insulin in a test tube, Genentech applied for a patent for insulin. Right at the onset, the company faced a series of unprecedented legal challenges. Since 1952, the United States Patent Act had specified that patents could be issued on 4 distinct categories of inventions: methods, machines, manufactured materials, and compositions of matter. The 4 M's, as lawyers like to call the categories. But how could insulin be pigeonholed into that list? It was a manufactured material, but virtually every human body could evidently manufacture it without Genentech's ministrations. It was a composition of matter, but also indisputably a natural product. Why was patenting insulin, the protein or its gene, different from patenting any other part of the human body, say, the nose or cholesterol? Genentech's approach to this problem was both ingenious and counterintuitive. Rather than patenting insulin as matter or manufacture, it concentrated its efforts boldly on a variation of method. Its application claimed a patent for a DNA vehicle to carry a gene into a bacterial cell and thereby produce a recombinant protein in a microorganism. The claim was so novel, no one had ever produced a recombinant human protein in a cell for medicinal use, that the audacity paid off. On October 26, 1982, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, USPTO, issued a patent to Genentech to use recombinant DNA to produce a protein such as insulin or somatostatin in a microbial organism. As one observer wrote, effectively, the patent claimed as an invention all genetically modified microorganisms. The Genentech patent would soon become one of the most lucrative and most hotly disputed patents in the history of technology. Insulin was a major milestone for the biotechnology industry and a blockbuster drug for Genentech, but it was not notably the medicine that would catapult gene cloning technology to the forefront of public imagination. In April 1982, a ballet dancer in San Francisco, Ken Horn, visited a dermatologist complaining of an inexplicable cluster of symptoms. Horn had felt weak for months and developed a cough. He had bouts of intractable diarrhea, and weight loss had hollowed his cheeks and made his neck muscles stand out like leather straps. His lymph nodes had swollen, and now he pulled his shirt up to demonstrate reticulated bumps were emerging on his skin, purple-blue of all colors, like hives in a macabre cartoon film. Horn's case was not isolated. Between May and August 1982, as the coast sweltered in a heat wave, similarly bizarre medical cases were reported in San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles. At the CDC in Atlanta, a technician was asked to fill 9 requests for pentamidine, an unusual antibiotic reserved to treat pneumocystis pneumonia. These requisitions made no sense. PCP was a rare infection that typically afflicted cancer patients with severely depleted immune systems. But these applications were for young men, previously in excellent health, whose immune systems had suddenly been pitched into inexplicable, catastrophic collapse. Horn, meanwhile, was diagnosed with Kaposi sarcoma, an indolent skin tumor found among old men in the Mediterranean. But Horn's case and the other 9 cases reported in the next 4 months bore little resemblance to the slow-growing tumors previously described as Kaposi's in the scientific literature. These were fulminant, aggressive cancers that spread rapidly through the skin and into the lungs, and they seemed to have a predilection for gay men living in New York and San Francisco. Horn's case mystified medical specialists. For now, as if to intersect puzzle upon puzzle, he developed pneumocystis pneumonia and meningitis as well. By late August, an epidemiological disaster was clearly appearing out of thin air. Noting the preponderance of gay men afflicted, doctors began to call it GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. Many newspapers accusingly termed it the gay plague. By September, the fallacy of that name had become evident. Symptoms of immunological collapse, including pneumocystis pneumonia and strange variants of meningitis, had now begun to sprout up among 3 patients with hemophilia A. Hemophilia, recall, was the bleeding illness of the English royals, caused by a single mutation in the gene for a crucial clotting factor in blood, called factor 8. For centuries, patients with hemophilia had lived in constant fear of a bleeding crisis. A nick in the skin could snowball into disaster. By the mid-1970s, though, hemophiliacs were being treated with injections of concentrated factor 8. Distilled out of thousands of liters of human blood, a single dose of the clotting factor was equivalent to 100 blood transfusions. A typical patient with hemophilia was thus exposed to the condensed essence of blood from thousands of donors. The emergence of the mysterious immunological collapse among patients with multiple blood transfusions pinpointed the cause of the illness to a blood-borne factor that had contaminated the supply of factor 8, possibly a novel virus. The syndrome was renamed Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, AIDS. In the spring of 1983, against the backdrop of the early AIDS cases, Dave Goodell at Genentech began to focus on cloning the factor 8 gene. As with insulin, the logic behind the cloning effort was immediately evident. Rather than purifying the missing clotting factor out of liters of human blood, why not create the protein artificially, using gene cloning? If factor 8 could be produced through gene cloning methods, it would be virtually free of any human contaminants, thereby rendering it inherently safer than any blood-derived protein. Waves of infections and deaths might be prevented among hemophiliacs. It was Goodell's old T-shirt slogan brought to life, clone or die. Goodell and Boyer were not the only geneticists